From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, President Trump has backed away from his threat to pull out of NAFTA, but he still wants to renegotiate the treaty. We'll talk about that with a Canadian economist.
I get scared with respect to the world economy, not just Canada.
Detroit's new top doctor spells out her agenda.
I'm a mother of three children. Even if one child in Detroit has an elevated blood lead level, that's one too many, and we need to do something about it.
Writer Ruth Behar takes her childhood experience of being badly hurt in a car crash and turns it into a children's novel, Lucky Broken Girl.
Certain things that I wished had been a certain way or imagined, oh, wouldn't it be nice if this happened. Well, I made it happen in the story.
And why women don't report sexual harassment on the job. Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up, we'll speak with Detroit's new top doctor. She's making lead and infant mortality top priorities.
I'm a mother of three children. Even if one child in Detroit has an elevated blood lead level, that's one too many, and we need to do something about it.
But first, the fallout from the sexual harassment scandal at Fox News continues. Co-president Bill Shine is the latest to leave the network. Although Shine has not been accused of harassment himself, a growing number of women at Fox News claim he was very aware of the inappropriate behavior against them and that he did nothing to address their concerns. This dismissive attitude by a top executive does not surprise Lilia Cortina. She's a professor of psychology and women's studies at the University of Michigan, and she's found that even though more and more workplaces have ways to report sexual harassment, women aren't using them. Let's find out why. Lilia Cortina, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You have studied how often people who have been harassed at work report it to a superior. Only a quarter to a third report, and only 2 to 13% file a formal complaint. That's kind of eye-popping. Why so low?
A big part of the problem is that many women and men as well fear the repercussions of complaining. They fear disbelief. They fear being retaliated against. They fear being dismissed and minimized. And unfortunately, through research, we know that those fears are well-founded.
Certainly the kinds of headlines that we're hearing, the pattern of corporate behavior that women at Fox News are describing,
exactly.
Pretty typical. So when people, not just women, as you say, but people try to report something, it's dismissed, it's poo-pooed, or even worse.
Correct. In one study where we looked at responses to a variety of types of complaining or speaking out against sexual harassment on the job, we found that around two-thirds of people who did speak out were retaliated against in some way, either professionally in terms of some kind of negative change in the job situation, or socially. So they were ostracized, they were shunned, they were treated as troublemakers.
Oh, you get that label. You know, it's interesting to note, too, the news stories focusing on Shine's departure, the fact that Fox News is elevating an executive named Suzanne Scott in his place, and she's been accused by some Fox News women, even in court, of trying to intimidate them or suppress their concerns. And that same accusation has been leveled against the network's chief lawyer, Diane Brandy. So that gets you thinking about company cultures and how they discourage people from reporting harassment, even as they're saying, you're welcome to come to HR.
Correct.
Is that window dressing?
So we know, again, from research that one of the most powerful predictors of whether sexual harassment happens and whether people report the harassment is the organizational culture around sexual harassment. Are complaints taken seriously? Are harassers penalized in some way, proportionate to the level of the offense? But is there some kind of negative repercussion for the people found guilty of engaging in inappropriate behavior? And on the other hand, are complainants retaliated against?
It seems that companies have got to get beyond saying to people, report it to HR. What are some concrete actions that companies should be taking to send a very clear message that sexual harassment and abuse will not be tolerated and that people can feel safe to step forward?
If someone has to fear for her job, were she to report her boss, then that's not an effective mechanism. It would not be reasonable to report in that context. So there should be a safe reporting mechanism that results in some kind of action. There should be also multiple reporting avenues, both formal and informal. And the informal piece could be, for example, having an organizational ombudsperson that you can speak to in confidence to find out your resources, to find out what avenues of recourse there may be. it does not have to all revolve around formal reporting as the only way to address the situation.
Because once you've taken that big step, then what? So this kind of lets people kind of begin to gently move toward that in feeling safe. I would imagine that having a lot of different people possible that you could go to. So if I'm
correct,
if I want to say something about a supervisor, there is a choice and I could go to someone with whom I feel comfortable.
Correct. Having multiple options, having the avenues of reporting be flexible, having both men and women you could report to, having people that speak your native language. English might not be your first language, so reporting only to management that only speaks English might not be reasonable in some contexts. Companies should design reporting systems with an eye towards encouraging people to come forward with complaints about any kind of offensive behavior, not necessarily behavior that rises to the level of a legal violation, because the company should intervene before it gets to that point. Policies around reporting should not include language around penalties for false complaints, because research also shows that most sexually harassing or other kinds of harassing behaviors do not get reported. There's very little evidence that false complaints are the least bit common. There could be the occasional one, but not common enough to build a whole policy around it. So the language in the policy should be entirely focused on encouraging people to come forward and reassuring them that it's safe to come forward.
Well, it would be interesting to see how all of this evolves as the attention is paid to this kind of story. University of Michigan psychologist Lilia Cortina, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your work with us.
Thank you for having me.
Detroit might be one of the largest social economic laboratories in the world. Billionaires are rehabbing iconic downtown buildings. The federal government is funding demolition of abandoned houses. And private foundations are testing out all kinds of projects to see just what might spark neighborhood revival. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham with the Detroit Journalism Cooperative reports on one of these experiments.
I was recently on Detroit's East Side, driving in the Morningside neighborhood. This street, Barham, is a favorite among illegal midnight dumpers. There are a lot of vacant lots. I was passing by a water heater. There was junk along the road. Up ahead, there were several mountains of broken concrete on the lot. A couch and old carpet were dumped in front of a stop sign. This street is odd in that one side, the houses face the street. On the other side, it's garages and backyards. It kind of reminds you of an alley. A nonprofit organization known for building affordable housing is based in this neighborhood. Linda Smith is the executive director of You Snap Back. She says they've been wondering what to do with Barham. Not that long ago, some University of Michigan students were looking it over.
One of the professors came to me to talk about doing some open lots, some space, some farmway, looking at the possibility of what could we do with Barham?
So they applied for a grant from Kresge Foundation. Kresge has been running a pilot program. This year, it's supporting 17 new projects in the neighborhoods. They include greenways, community hubs, youth engagement, artists and parks, and more. The Morningside project got $150,000 of the $2 million given away this year. Brian Hogel is a program officer with Kresge.
Basically what the grant does is that allows them to do some work to transform a half-mile stretch of Barham that's highly vacant into a greenway and farmway. This is land that's been the place of a lot of dumping and blight, and they're looking to change that and change it from a liability for the neighborhood into an asset.
Now, with all the problems many of the neighborhoods in Detroit face, you have to wonder why a greenway or why artists in parks. Hogel says the neighborhood groups met with the residents. Lots of ideas were gathered, and they built a consensus. In Morningside, Linda Smith says people wanted a place to walk dogs, a place for kids to ride their bicycles, and more fresh food. This agricultural greenway will do all of that, and It should be self-sustaining. Farmers will lease the land. Smith says there's a demand by farmers who want more space to grow food.
They want to be able to just grow their crop like anyone else, but they don't want to deal with the land bank. They don't want to deal with the city. They want to be able to lease land that's already been prepped to do what they want to do. So that's what's exciting.
Although Smokey was not happy about it, I talked to Marvin, who lives next to Barham Street. He didn't want to give his last name.
It's a good idea as long as they keep it clean. And if they plant a garden in there for all the neighbors to participate, it'd be a good thing for them.
One of the things we're talking about is actually leasing it to farmers who would grow crops and then sell them to the neighbors.
That'd be good, too. We need something in the neighborhood so people can get more interacting with the neighbors. Yep, that's what we need.
One of the few houses along Barham that faces the street is a neat brick house where Faith Williams lives. She recently bought a vacant lot next door. The new Barham Greenway will adjoin that lot.
That sounds nice to me. It sounds like a very good idea. Yeah, I would even help them, you know, keep the greenery up.
Soon, Linda Smith at You Snap Back will be getting some more help to make sure the project is successful. Chase Bank will be loaning 4 executives to the project for a month. They'll design a business plan for the agricultural greenway. With the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, I'm Lester Graham, Michigan Radio News.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Coming up, Theater Talk, our regular look at what's happening in professional theater around Michigan. And then, Ruth Behar and Lucky Broken Girl.
She learns to have empathy for all the people around her and to see that she's not the only one who suffers. So there's the luckiness of that, of learning so much about being human.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. To Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for Theater Talk as we look at professional theater companies all around our state. David Colley of Encore Michigan is back with us again. And David, I think when people drive past the Max M. Fisher Center right next to Orchestra Hall in Detroit, they probably don't know there's a really great theater company called the Detroit Public Theater tucked in there. And their current play right now is The Harassment of Iris Molloy.
Yeah, this play is a drama from playwright Zach Berman about a single mother who has an intimate encounter with a U.S. senator. And the story, which you can almost really imagine being pulled from today's headlines, is a real study into sex, power, class distinctions. Jeff Button, who's the director, he's a native of Grosse Pointe and went to college at Western Michigan, though he works mostly in Chicago these days. And you're right, the Detroit Public is located at 3711 Woodward.
And Detroit Public Theater really hasn't been around very long, has it?
Just 2 full seasons, but they've done some really nice work. They've moved into being an equity theater. It's a terrific space. I think it seats about 100 or so people. So it's a wonderful experience.
Really intimate space.
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. Over to that unique little theater in my hometown of Ferndale, The Ringwald. And speaking of unique, their current production is exactly that, Silence the Musical.
This is the story of Clarice.
Killers have been willing to chat with us, but the one we want the most refuses to cooperate.
Who?
The psychiatrist, Hannibal Lecter.
Hannibal the Cannibal.
So this is from Silence of the Lambs?
Yes, it is. And it's quite a departure from the play we were just talking about. The Ringwald is a small theater on Woodward Avenue in Ferndale, and it's Silence the Musical, which is an unauthorized musical parody of the film Silence of the Lambs. And this has been a successful show in New York and also, I believe, London. And it's touring now and it's available. But this is the first time it's in Michigan. This show is great fun. If you've never been to the Ringwald, it is a charming, no-frills theater with plenty of places around to have a bite to eat or a drink before the show or after. It's a storefront theater, but don't let that deter you. The work that they do inside is award-winning, and there's a wonderful local actor named John DeMerrill who's playing Hannibal Lecter.
Oh, fun. Mask and all, I've got to imagine. Yeah. And I think it's the understatement of the year to say there are a lot of places to eat and drink for your theater night out because Ferndale is just packed with that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And there it is right at 9 Mile and Woodward, so mm-hmm. you can't miss it. Very, very fun, the Ringwald Theater. And then we're going to head west of Kalamazoo to the Wataydo Theater in Springfield with their revival of Tennessee Williams' Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Right. Springfield, actually, it's actually east of Kalamazoo. It's about 20, 25 miles east of Kalamazoo, right off 94. This theater, which seats about 100, they're doing Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, as you say. It's not a play that's done very often, not around Michigan. Most people have seen the film with Paul Newman and Elizabeth Taylor and Burl Ives. I just saw David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross at this theater. It was very good. Again, it's a really intimate, terrific space to see a Tennessee Williams classic.
You know, it's interesting because my understanding was this is Williams' personal favorite, and as you're right, it isn't done a whole lot. And boy, you get some steamy, steamy Southern drama there.
and I love the whole Burl Ives character, Big Daddy, which I've actually used a speech from that show for my own auditions.
Because it's so good.
Yeah.
And now we're heading to Pinckney, to the Dio Dinner Entertainment Theater. And what's playing there?
Well, they're playing The Bridges in Madison County.
You could have driven into someone else's driveway. You could have tried to find the bridge another day. I could have gone off to the fair, or locked the door, or washed my hair. And in a way, that would be better.
And this is the musical that was adapted from the book and the film of the same name. Had a nice Broadway run and is getting done increasingly in regional theater. We've reviewed it already. There's a few more weeks left in the run. And the story for this show, for me, is the actress who plays Francesca, Marlene Inman, who was in your studios last February because she was a co-star in the play that I was here to talk about. She's really sublime. I mean, our reviewer, wasn't that me, gave her incredibly high marks, as has every other reviewer who has seen it, for really embodying the whole character of Francesca.
And what a great role.
It is a terrific role. Her co-star, John McCatton, is also very good. He came in from New York to play the Robert Kincaid character. And I also should say it is dinner and theater. They usually serve dinner about 6:15 to 6:20 on their Friday and Saturday night shows. And then the show gets going by about 7:30, and the food is good. And this show, even better.
So you get a full night out. So to recap, the Detroit Public Theater, The Harassment of Iris Molloy, The Ringwald in Ferndale, Silence the Musical, too funny, The Wataydo Theater in Springfield, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, and the Dio Dinner Entertainment Theater in Pinckney, Bridges of Madison County. You can get all the details on these and other plays all around Michigan. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, Encore Michigan, always great talking with you. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. An auto accident leaves a little girl with a shattered leg. She spends the next year in bed in a body cast, wondering if she'd ever be back in school, ever back playing hopscotch outside with her friends. At the same time, she and her family are trying to build new lives. They are Cuban Jews who fled Castro's Cuba for a new life in New York City. That is the true story behind Ruth Behar's first novel, Lucky Broken Girl. Ruth is a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. We have spoken to her before on Stateside about Cuba, and it is a pleasure Ruth Behar to welcome you back and say congratulations on your first novel.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back talking to you, Cynthia.
This is a beautifully drawn story told from the point of view of a little girl named Ruthie, who is badly hurt in this terrible car crash, and the things she learns while she's lying in that body cast. And this is you, isn't it?
It is me, and it is not me.
Yes.
I mean, we were really in this car accident shortly after we arrived from Cuba, so that part is all true, and I did end up in a body cast for close to a year in bed, so that part is all true. My poor family experienced it with me, family and friends and neighbors, so all of that is true, but I also sweetened the story a little bit. I sweetened a lot of the characters, made them all a little bit nicer than they were in real life, and tried to give it, at points, almost a fairy tale dimension. So that's where I became the fiction writer, and certain things that I wished had been a certain way or imagined, oh, wouldn't it be nice if this happened? Well, I made it happen in the story.
the power of the pen.
It really is the power of the pen, and the power of being able to use your imagination after a very long career as an anthropologist, which is not to say I haven't used my imagination as an anthropologist, but you're writing about things that really happened, things you took notes about, things you tape recorded, and you want to be very accurate. Here, I was accurate in terms of, yes, this happened, and I had to portray the family accurately and all the details of the injury and so on, but there were certain things I could elaborate on and embellish, and that was very fun.
And what kind, just as people go through the book and read it, what do we want to peel away any of the layers and let people know what maybe was sweetened, or do you want to leave that to everyone's imagination?
No, I'm happy to share some of the moments that gave me such pleasure to write. So, you know, I was in bed for a very long time, and we were in a small apartment in Queens in New York, and you know, the doctor told my parents, don't move her. And so because I didn't move, I was always facing the same direction for close to a year. And so I imagined, wouldn't it be nice if little Ruthie was taken outside? Mm-hmm. And so I created this scene where it's New Year's Day and the two attendants come, Clay and Bobby are the names I gave them. And they come on New Year's Day and they give Ruthie the surprise of taking her out to see the snow. The snow has just started to fall. They take her out in the stretcher. They put a blanket on her. And she's there with her little brother and her little cousins. And they build a snowman together. And she gets to enjoy the snow and then be brought back inside. Well, that didn't happen. But it's such a beautiful scene. My parents, who have now read the book, they think it happened. They said, yeah, that was so nice. And I said, actually, that never happened.
Sorry, Mom. Hate to tell you.
But now I think, you know what? These beautiful scenes, these beautiful sweet scenes, they're magical. I'm just going to say, yeah, it happened just like that because they feel so good. Mm. So that's one of them. And then, you know, my father got sweetened up quite a lot as well. You definitely see that he's a very strict disciplinarian father. But at the same time, I gave him a role where he's buying go-go boots, yes, for Ruthie, which she very much desires since the story is taking place in 1966.
And we all wanted the go-go boots in 1966.
We all wanted go-go, yes, boots. It was the year of the famous song, yes, These Boots Are Made for Walking. Yeah. And so he's the one that brings the go-go boots to her. So, you know, so I added these elements where everybody got to be as they are, but they also got these sweetened elements.
And really underpinning all of that, you give us such a clear understanding through Ruthie's eyes. And how old are we talking with Ruthie?
When was this? She's 10.
She's 10.
She's 10 years old.
So old enough to process and understand, still a child. And we get this understanding of how she and her family were struggling to feel at home in their new home and how much they missed Cuba. With that in mind, I wonder if you'd read us an excerpt from Lucky Broken Girl.
Oh, sure.
And this is where we get the first kind of idea of how the family is living in their new apartment in Queens.
Oh, sure. We just have one bedroom in our apartment, and Mommy and Poppy give it to Izzy and me. They got a Castro convertible sofa for themselves that doubles as a bed. Every night, Mommy pulls open the sofa and makes the bed, tucking the sheets into the wire frame that scratches her hands. And every morning, she turns it back into a sofa, folding it up like an accordion. She sighs when she opens and closes the sofa. Mommy misses Cuba, where we had an apartment with two bedrooms and a balcony that looked out at the ocean and let in the breezes and the sunshine. She misses standing on the balcony and lowering the basket down with a rope for the peddler to fill with pineapples and coconuts. She misses the people who smile at you in the street, even if they don't know who you are. And she misses the tall palm trees that tickle the sky. Now she and Papi have to sleep in an uncomfortable sofa called Castro, the name of the man who stole their country from them.
That's Ruth Behar reading from her first novel called Lucky Broken Girl. It's based on Ruth's experiences of being a Cuban Jewish immigrant in New York in the 1960s and the years she spent in a body cast while she recovered from the shattered leg that she suffered in a car crash. How therapeutic was it for you to dig into these things that happened to you? This was rough stuff. I mean, the accident that, you know, with your family all together and having to live in that body cast. What was that like for you to go through it?
I think it was very, very therapeutic. It was almost as if this child I had been was just like sending a rope towards me and saying, here, I'm here, I'm still there, the child is still there, I haven't gone away. And that child really wanted to speak. And I think it had to do with the fact that even though my family took very good care of me, at the same time, they were somewhat exasperated by the whole thing. You know, it's like, get better already. You know? And there was nothing I could do. I just had to wait to heal. So I felt tremendous exasperation and also a sense that, yes, I was suffering, but others had suffered more. There were several people who died in the accident, the young men who were in the car that caused the accident, all of them died. And there was a man in the car in front of us who was with his girlfriend who died, and the girlfriend ended up paralyzed. So there's always a sense of, yeah, your situation's terrible, but there are these other people that had an even worse situation. So don't feel so sorry for yourself. Yeah. So I think there was a lot of that. And I think because of that, I healed and then I just tried to forget and move on. And so it was therapeutic in the sense of letting Ruthie finally speak and feel for her that this was a terrible thing she went through. It's not much fun being an active child and suddenly being in bed. And here it was as if Ruthie was telling me her story like way from the past, like from half a century ago. Mm-hmm. This girl wanted to be listened to, and that little girl had been me. But now, you know, I was far away from that girl. And this rope was extended, like, here, grab this rope and pull me in. And so that part was very, very therapeutic.
And is it from this perspective of 50 years later that you can call her a lucky broken girl? The title of the book?
I think so. I think 50 years later, I was able to see the ways in which she was lucky. And the luck had to do with this idea that when one door closes, another door opens. And so in the book, she's Miss Hopscotch, Queen of Queens. You know, she's a dynamo. She's fast. She's strong. And then she's in bed for a year. And this totally changes her life. One of the most amazing things that happened is we were these immigrants from Cuba, and my public school sent a tutor to our house. That part was real. And I have never ceased to be amazed by that. That's when I really felt we're in America. You know, they cared enough to send a tutor to our house, or I would have been out of school for an entire year. This is before homeschooling and things like that. Plus, I was adjusting to English. I was still really learning the language.
No online classes.
No online classes, no internet. And that was the year that I became smart because the tutor brought me books. We couldn't afford books. We didn't have books in the house. The tutor brought me books. She taught me math. And after that year, that's when I became a super smart, nerdy girl who liked to read. And so that's the lucky part where she was broken, but there was this luck that came out of the brokenness and sort of finding the luck. It means that she lost something. She couldn't be the hopscotch queen anymore of Queens. She lost that sense of spontaneity that she had about her body because she became too careful. So she lost that, but she had the other luck of becoming smart, which was something else that she dreams of being at the beginning of the book. She wants to be smart, and she's being viewed as dumb just because she doesn't speak English. And so that was really cool. So that's where the luck comes in. But there's also luck in the fact that she learns so much about the people around her. She learns to have empathy for all the people around her and to see that she's not the only one who suffer. So there's the luckiness of that, of learning so much about being human.
And she finds friendship where she might least expect it. And that there's a lot of surprises and delights to be discovered even in the midst of a trying situation. What ages would you say this book is good for?
Well, this is ages 10 and up, mm-hmm. so 5th, 6th graders should be able to read it. I've already been speaking to kids, speaking to 6th graders, and I went to a school in Los Angeles recently where I read aloud and they had the books and they followed along with me, which was extremely exciting. So yeah, so ages 10 and up, but my hope is that it's a bit of an ageless book and that younger kids can read it if it's read to them, and that older kids and adults might find it interesting as well.
Oh, as an adult reader, I thought it was very, very wonderful. And it does give us a sensitive understanding of the kinds of things that tug at a family as they're saying goodbye to one home and trying to learn to love a new home. It's a lovely book, Lucky Broken Girl by Ruth Behar, her debut novel. Very different from your work as a professor of anthropology at the University of Michigan. Congratulations on it, Ruth. The book launch is tonight at 7 p.m. at Literati in downtown Ann Arbor. Congratulations. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. President Trump talks a lot about renegotiating NAFTA. And there are few places that would feel the fallout from changing the North American Free Trade Agreement than Michigan and Ontario. Let's look at just what NAFTA has meant to the economies of Michigan and Ontario. Bernard Wolf is a professor emeritus of economics and international business at York University in Toronto. Professor Wolf, thank you so much for being with us today.
A pleasure.
Have Michigan and Ontario had a pretty closely connected economy and trade relationship even prior to NAFTA?
Definitely. In 1965, the U.S. and Canada signed the so-called Auto Pact, in which basically allowed free trade in vehicles and parts between the two countries. It rationalized the Canadian industry, and you ended up with a huge amount of cross-border traffic. An item might start out in Michigan, be put into another part in Ontario, shipped again to Michigan, then some value added, shipped again to Ontario, back and forth across the border, and say end up in the U.S.
So starting with that agreement in the mid-60s, and then we go to NAFTA in the 1990s, how did that affect our trade and economies?
It strengthened the relationship between Canada and the U.S. and added Mexico in. So now you have really a very intricate supply chain with basically small or very small vehicles produced in Mexico, labor-intensive parts produced in Mexico, then the greater value-added products produced in Michigan and Ontario.
What do you see as the industries that got the biggest boost from this trade deal? Clearly, automotive is a part of that. What else got a boost from NAFTA, in your view?
Manufacturing in general, agriculture. I mean, almost anything you can think of. You know, you got a vast amount of traffic. The amount of trade increased enormously to both countries' benefit.
From your economist's eye view, were there downsides for either Michigan or Ontario from NAFTA?
No, I don't really see any downside. I think this was very much a win-win situation.
When you hear the president talking about renegotiating NAFTA, what does that mean to you? What would it mean to renegotiate such a major trade deal?
Well, that's hard to say, you know, from these little tweaks. Basically, he's called NAFTA the worst trade treaty, named it everything under the sun in a negative way. What he wants to do, I think, is basically say, hey, we want to really change that trade balance with Mexico. The notion of an equal trade balance makes no sense to an economist in any event, but he has these notions. So in terms of what he does here in Canada, he talks about tweaking. I think Canada and Mexico certainly would like to keep this trilateral deal. However, we'll see how the chips fall.
Would you explain, as you said, that then the notion of equal trade relationship, it doesn't work. explain to us, just in terms of economics, why that is.
Well, you ought to be really producing in a place what you can produce relatively better than elsewhere. So if labor is very cheap in Mexico, then you should be producing labor-intensive goods in Mexico and much less labor-intensive goods, say, in the U.S. Everybody will be better off with that trade, or at least both countries. That doesn't mean everyone in the countries will be better off, because some people get displaced when production moves from one to another.
And that has certainly been a theme of the president, you know, through the campaign and since he took office.
Yes, there has certainly been a displacement of manufacturing to low-wage countries. However, manufacturing has been declining in the U.S. and elsewhere in developed countries for years. And actually, most of the closing of factories and such is due to technology, technological change, not really due to international trade. At times, a country ought to actually have a current account deficit and a capital surplus. So if the, you know, if there's a lot of investment coming into the country, then you may actually want a trade deficit. You shouldn't be interested in really in the deficit between one country and another, but your overall worldwide situation.
Professor, let's look at what a thicker border would mean for Ontario and Michigan. How could that change if NAFTA is, as the president says, tweaked?
A thicker border would, in fact, very much hurt both countries, probably particularly Canada. Overall, I mean, if production had to shift into the U.S. and you cut off the supply chains to the U.S. and Mexico to an extent, it would mean that you're going to produce whatever parts or such or vehicles in the U.S., and it's going to be more expensive to produce them, and that's going to mean higher prices for the consumer. So this really makes no sense. You have this, you know, intricate supply chains, and you'll be cutting off the supply chains. And those supply chains have a reason for being there. The reason is that, you know, it's much more efficient to do things this way. Basically, what you're doing is turning back the clock, trying to go back to a period where, you know, if we go back to the Auto Pact in terms of Canada, Canada was really producing a wide variety of vehicles in very, very small quantities at very, very expensive cost. So what the Auto Pact is, it rationalized and allowed Canadian plants to specialize. Now, the border would have to go way up for that to happen again. But anything that, in fact, makes that border thicker, that border harder to penetrate, is going to make the industry as a whole much more inefficient. Certainly, the costs in the U.S. are certainly going to rise. There's no question about that. And as I said, the consumer will, in fact, have to bear the price.
Well, as I look at an Ontario trade fact sheet, it's certainly clear looking at top export destinations and import sources that basically Michigan and Ontario are importing and exporting the heck out of each other. So there are so many ties as far as our trade.
Absolutely. And not only trade, but also investment, in fact. There is a substantial Canadian investment in Michigan, and of course there's a great deal of investment in Canada, particularly in Ontario, by Michigan companies. So you've not only got the trade, but you've got an investment. And again, this investment is part of the supply chain.
Professor, taking that economist's broad view, what do you worry about when you hear Donald Trump talk about trade? I mean, how do you think the president could affect the economy of Canada?
Well, I get scared with respect to the world economy, not just Canada. You know, if we go back to the 1930s and what happened when the U.S. became isolationist and put up walls, you ended up with the Great Depression. I'm not saying that's the only reason for the Depression. However, the fact that you did not allow goods to be produced more efficiently than they were when you had open lines of trade ended up with a situation where the U.S., with its Moot-Hawley tariff, really increased barriers to a very considerable extent, and other countries retaliated and trade shrunk, and with it, productivity fell, output fell, and you ended up with a Great Depression. I'm not suggesting that's going to happen now, but protection is dangerous. Again, it turns back the clock. We've made real strides in integrating the world and increasing world trade in the last 20, 30 years. and to turn back the clock is absolutely, you know, dangerous, extremely dangerous. And for Canada, which is a small open trading economy, it's particularly harmful. Canada now has a so-called free trade agreement with Europe, so Canada will be looking much more to Europe and Asia because, you know, it isn't able to export as much to the U.S.
Bernard Wolf is a professor emeritus of economics and international business at the Schulich School of Business at York University in Toronto. Professor Wolf, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside today.
Great talking to you.
Two of the biggest public health problems we face in Michigan are lead poisoning and infant mortality. Michigan's infant mortality rate is more than a full point ahead of the national rate. Roughly 7 babies out of every 1,000 born in Michigan do not live to their first birthday. In Detroit, that rate is twice as high. As for lead, Flint certainly comes to mind, but there is much more to our lead problem. The new executive director and health officer of the Detroit Health Department is making lead and infant mortality her top priorities. Dr. Jonay Khaldun stepped into that top spot earlier this year after the previous director, Abdul Al-Sayed, stepped down to run for governor. Dr. Khaldun is here with us now. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I want to start by talking about this initiative, Lead Safe Detroit. I mean, we know Detroit's water is safe. So where are the lead dangers and how would this initiative protect kids?
Well, we know the number of elevated lead levels in Detroit children has decreased by 50% since 2009. However, in 2015, we also know that 9% of tested children had elevated blood lead levels, which is way too high. I'm a mother of 3 children. Even if one child in Detroit has an elevated blood lead level, that's one too many, and we need to do something about it. So Detroit is really committed to preventing lead poisoning in all Detroit children, and that's what Lead Safe Detroit is about. It's a collaborative, multi-agency effort to increase education and lead testing, and also to enforce these lead abatement laws. We've already seen improvements in the number of elevated lead cases that have been investigated and the number of homes that have been inspected for lead hazards.
And you're offering free testing. It's just a matter of you need to get that message out and have people bring their kids in.
Yes, any child in Detroit under age 6 can come to one of our clinics. We have 2 clinics, one at Family Place on the east side and the other at Samaritan Center. Any child can come to one of our clinics and be tested for lead free of charge.
You know, you stop and you think about something that was done, like using paint 50 years ago, that no one had any concept that there would be this boomerang effect and become such a health risk down the road. And you're probably always, as somebody in public health, looking to be ahead of this and keep on top of this kind of challenge.
Absolutely. I mean, like you said, 93% of houses in Detroit were built before 1978 when using lead-based paint was common. So it's not that anyone did this on purpose. It's just that they didn't know. And now that we know, we have to do something and be proactive about it. So that's why we're encouraging every parent to get their child tested. We're helping parents understand that their children should be eating healthy food so that if they are exposed to lead, they're able to help fight the effects of it. And making sure our parents know things about cleaning their homes appropriately so that if there is lead-based paint, their children are protected and their homes are cleaned properly.
Let's talk about that infant mortality rate. It's a challenge for Michigan and an even bigger challenge in Detroit. Where is the infant mortality rate right now in the city of Detroit?
So we know that black babies in Detroit are twice as likely to die before their first birthday as other babies across the state of Michigan. We have over 100 programs in the city focusing on maternal child health. And really, we have some of the greatest cutting-edge medical care in the country. So it's not that we need another program. It's not that we don't have medical care. What's really missing is the glue. And that glue is the community that embraces and celebrates young women in Detroit, and celebrates a young woman who's pregnant and helps them connect to services, answer their questions, and be a real mental and social support that's so critical to having a healthy pregnancy.
And thus this really interesting, exciting initiative, Sister Friends Detroit. And it's a volunteer effort, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And I always say this, the greatest asset of Detroit are really its residents, the community. when we're building out our programs, we're really making sure that we're building on that and engaging the community in a way that really supports and promotes the health of the city. So Sister Friends, like you said, is a volunteer effort. We are matching pregnant women with volunteers across the city. All you have to do is be interested and to care, and you can be matched with a young pregnant woman. And what you do is help them connect to resources, and you're really just an emotional and practical support for that young woman throughout their pregnancy. I know my family and my friend support was critical to me having healthy and positive birth outcomes, and that's really what Sister Friends is about.
How does that help fight infant mortality? I guess the flip side of that, when you think of the contributors to infant mortality, how does it tackle that?
What Sister Friends does is really provide that support to connect to services. So a pregnant mom, often they may know that they're supposed to go to their physician appointment, but they have a problem getting transportation, mm-hmm. or they may need someone to help them watch their other children. So that Sister Friend can help provide child care, if possible. They can help them connect and make sure they're going to their doctor's appointments. If they have any questions that maybe they didn't feel comfortable talking to their physicians about, that Sister Friend is there to help and support them. So it's really whatever that young mom needs, that's what a Sister Friend is there to do.
You grew up in Ann Arbor, and I know you did your undergrad at U of M, and your residency was in emergency medicine. What drew you to public health, Dr. Khaldun?
So I often tell people I probably went into medicine more so for my public health interest and didn't realize it until I got into my medical career. I'll be honest, when I was at the University of Michigan as a college student, I actually worked in the transplant center. So I was an organ preservation technician. And what that meant is that I traveled with the transplant surgeons to get organs from people who unfortunately were deceased. And often people who are able to donate organs, they are able to do so because they are brain dead, which basically means that something has gone on with their brain, but the rest of their body is working okay. And so that was really my first introduction to injuries and violence, because that was often the way in which those individuals passed away. And so really what that brought to me was the fact that so many of these injuries are preventable. And so there's something we can do about it and something we can be doing in our communities to support people with education and programs so that they can prevent unnecessary deaths.
And now I know from Chief Medical Officer for the Baltimore City Health Department and come back to Michigan. And, you know, I saw some statistics that in 2015, Baltimore was investing something like $41 per person per year as a city in their people. Detroit was investing $1.50 per person per year in that year. How do you overcome that to build the health department into what it needs to be?
Well, yes. A couple of years ago, that is how much Detroit as a city was investing into public health. But I'm excited to say that thanks to the leadership of Mayor Duggan and our city council, we've actually increased that. So the city is now putting in $10 million a year to support public health in the city. And that's a significant increase from even a couple of years ago. And so I think what it really is that we're really just understanding that we're trying to fight intergenerational poverty. And to do that, you have to bring programs to people, including our immunizations program, including our lead program, including programs like Sister Friends. I think that I know that the mayor and city council really believes in that. And so that's why we've seen the increase and the support in building out the public health infrastructure in Detroit.
If you and I are having a sitting down and talking in 5 years, what do you want us to be talking about?
I want us to be talking about how the infant mortality rate decreased across the city. I want us to be talking about how we've been able to decrease violence, the violent injuries and injury prevention in the city. I want us to be talking about how the health department is now in every community. There's no longer the old days of the Herman Kiefer where everyone had to come to us for services. The health department is now in the community. You don't have to travel outside of 20 minutes to get to health department programs and services. And most importantly, we're seeing some significant improvements in these health outcomes that we've talked about.
Dr. Joanne Khaldun, who is the new executive director and health officer for the Detroit Health Department. It was great to spend time talking with you, and I look forward to further conversations.
Thank you so much for having me today.
And join me tomorrow for our final State of Opportunity special here on Michigan Radio. We'll spend the hour looking at three of the project's key focuses: infant mortality, early childhood education, and what happens when young people age out of foster care. That's Wednesday afternoon on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.